Studio 360 is supported by 23andMe. 23andMe provides a personal DNA kit so individuals can better understand how their genes impact health, which helps individuals and their doctors find health areas to keep an eye on. 23andMe also gives ancestry information and helps discover personal global origins or perhaps find living relatives. The Personal DNA Kit, designed to give individuals more control over their personal health, available at 23andme.com/studio360.
Today in Studio 360,
I got bad news for you.
Kids don't have to sneak into R-rated movies anymore because there's way more violence in the PG-13.
See, their morals, their code, it's a bad joke.
Parents strongly cautioned gun violence has tripled in the movies your kids go to see without you.
The kind of paradoxical effect is now to have movies with just a little bit of language, a little bit of sex, ending up as an R, and movies with a lot of violence getting to PG-13.
And later, the beautiful, haunting music of a young Canadian who calls herself Cold Specs.
I will teach these long stairs.
It's what she calls doom soul gothic gospel. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Hello, folks.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Don't get scared and start turning off your radios. I'm not advertising or trying to sell you anything.
I've always been fascinated by Will Rogers, the superstar radio personality, newspaper columnist, movie actor, and the sharpest, most influential political humorist of the 1920s and 30s. As part of our Peabody Award-winning series, Inside the National Recording Registry, we will unpack his most important speech, Bacon, Beans, and Limousines. That's ahead in this hour of the show. But to start things off, back in the 1970s and early 80s, there was really no middle ground between PG and R-rated movies. Anybody could tell one from the other. Then in 1984, Steven Spielberg released Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. The movie got a PG rating, even though, as you heard there, one character pulls another character's still beating heart from his chest. Parents complained about that. Steven Spielberg called the head of the Motion Picture Association of America, requesting that they establish a new tier. And a year later, we had PG-13, a rating that warns parents, quote, some material may be inappropriate for children under 13. Now, a new study published in the journal Pediatrics raises a few questions about the rating. It found that gun violence in PG-13 movies, characters shooting other characters, has tripled since 1985, and that the amount of shooting and killing in PG-13 movies now exceeds the mayhem in R-rated movies. Steven Zajcik is an arts and entertainment writer at the LA Times. Steven, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Good to be here.
So this study out of Ohio State and the Annenberg Public Policy Center says that gun violence has tripled in PG-13 movies the last 30 years. Is that because there's more violence in movies generally, or the standards for what is a PG-13 movie have gotten looser and looser?
Well, actually, I think it's both. I think yes and yes. I think what's happened in movies over the last, say 20 to 25 years, but certainly after Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom helped establish the rating, is that there has been a lot more violence. And I think concurrently what's happened is that the studios, perhaps because the movies have gotten so much bigger, there's so much more money riding on them, the studios, who of course comprise the MPAA, have said, you know what, we want to make sure that these movies can still be seen by the widest possible audience. So all these violent films, which I think in another era would have been rated R, as the study suggests, are now getting either a very lenient PG-13 rating, or what's happening is that a studio or a director are going back and kind of, trimming and nipping and tucking, but the net effect is still the same, that there's just a lot of violence, even in movies that kids could see.
What are some of the signature films of the last few years that are driving this?
I think the superhero film that we've kind of seen now become a summer staple certainly fits the bill. And The Hunger Games Catching Fire, the sequel to the very popular YA adaptation of last year, movie is coming out this weekend. And, there isn't as much gun violence in it, but there are a couple of scenes that are particularly disturbing, including one whipping scene. But, of course, there you go, PG-13.
So as this great YA hit of the last few years, The Hunger Games, is violence in a literary form. We have video games that are extremely violent. Is it just that we have gotten inured to this fictional violence and therefore the MPAA is loosening and loosening and loosening and allowing 12 and 13-year-olds to see whatever?
Well, certainly that would be their justification. You know, whenever you ask the ratings board what it is that's allowing this evolution, such as it is, they will say, well, you know, standards change. And that is true. You know, I think that it just feels a little bit like because the standard is applied only to violence, there does not seem to be an evolving attitude on language, for example, certainly on sex, that it seems to be driven somewhat more by economics and then by a redefined moral standard. The kind of paradoxical effect is now to have movies with just a little bit of language, a little bit of sex ending up as an R, and movies with a lot of violence getting to PG-13.
The study says, of course, that watching all this violence can lead to increases in aggressive behavior and so forth. But the last 20 years, certainly, we've seen a dramatic reduction in crime and gun homicides in the United States. How does that figure into this calculus and debate?
I think you can kind of make a very cogent argument for why we should reduce violence in movies that without making a very specific connection to, a murder rate, for example, or something, or mass shootings. There's no question there's been a number of tragic and high-profile mass shootings in the last couple of years. But I think once you start making those direct connections, you're really opening up a bit of a Pandora's box. And I'm not sure that that was the most compelling part of the study.
And does the whole idea of a rating system for which theaters you can go to, isn't that going to become obsolete pretty quickly if it hasn't already?
Well, it's funny you say that because we actually did a big story on the NC-17 a year or two back. And, you know, when we did that story, you know, what was so funny is, you know, seeing how scenes are parsed in films for whether it should get the NC-17 or it shouldn't. It's stuff that kids or anyone can get, you know, on the internet with just, you know, the
right
click of a wrist and the click of a mouse button. So if anyone really wanted to see it, they won't have to sneak into a movie theater to do it.
And do you suspect that if you and I began a movement to say, okay, every movie with any kind of violence over a certain level must be an R, that the Hollywood studios would crush us?
It'll never happen. And, you know, the only thing I think that could happen, and even this is probably a long shot, and, not to say we're all shouting into the wind, but the studios are pretty entrenched on this. But I do think there's always been the possibility of a more strict rating between the PG-13 and the R. There have been various movements over the years to try to start that. Whether there's enough momentum now to get that going again, I don't know. But the idea that they're actually going to change anything they put in films anytime soon, I think is unfortunately a pipe dream.
Steven Zajcik, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Steven Zajcik writes about film and the film industry for the Los Angeles Times. So what do you think? If you're a parent or a kid, for that matter, do movie ratings mean anything to you? Do you want to see the rating system change? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. Don't you ever ask them why. If they told you, you would cry.
This week, we're launching a new extra credit listener challenge, so get ready to start your creative engines. This one involves a cutting-edge technology that is about to take over the world, 3D printing.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is.
To the power of another dimension.
Turn on the printer, will you? I want to get a print out of this.
For the challenge, we're partnering with MakerBot, the pioneering company that wants to bring 3D printers into every home. Say that one of the little buttons is missing on your remote control, or your kid's toy car has a broken spoke, or you want new temples for your eyeglasses. You could just print them. That's right. You could just print new ones. To see how the thing works, I went to MakerBot's storefront in New York to get the lowdown from the founder and CEO.
Welcome, Kurt. I'm Bree Pettis, and you're here at the MakerBot store here on Mulberry Street in Manhattan.
And you are, if not the king of 3D printing, a prince of 3D printing. What is 3D printing for those of our listeners who don't know?
Sure. 3D printing is a process where you have an idea and you either download a digital design or you create a digital design on your computer, and then the 3D printer creates it in 3D. It does that by building it up layer by layer.
With what? What is the material out of which these objects are made?
We use this great material called PLA, which is a renewable bioplastic made from corn. And it's got super high dimensional tolerance, great accuracy, really beautiful detail, and it just makes beautiful objects.
The scanning part, how does that work? If I have some little trinket or keychain I would love a copy of, you can scan that and 3D print it, right?
Yeah, we've got the MakerBot Digitizer is a desktop 3D scanner, and you can put things on the turntable, and it's kind of like an old record turntable, uh-huh. Except instead of having a record like tone arm, it's got lasers, and the lasers shoot at the object, and the object turns around, and it turns it from a physical object into a digital object.
And I know that all kinds of industrial designers and companies are doing quick prototypes, and instead of just having a sketch, they make a version of the thing, so these are being used in the real world. There are also just ordinary people, hobbyists, people who just want to play around with this. I assume that's a lot of your clientele.
Yeah, I mean, people who buy MakerBot replicators and MakerBot digitizers are a mix. I mean, one of our biggest customers is NASA, but then also it's just parents and teachers and folks who just want to live one step into the future. And, you know, it's kind of like when I was a kid and my family, I was the first kid to have an Apple II Plus on the block. You can be the first family on your block to have a MakerBot. And, you know, we're rapidly approaching the time when everybody's going to know somebody who has a 3D printer.
Uh-huh.
And
like TVs in the early 50s and
exactly.
Computers in the early 80s. And they, in terms of their cost, they cost, you know, it's not cheap, but it's probably less than your Apple was 30 years ago in real life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's basically the MakerBot Replicator 2 is $2,200. The MakerBot Digitizer is $1,400.
Uh-huh.
You know, these pieces of equipment are kind of on par with your laptop, a nice laptop.
Right. Should we go look at
let's go check the
machines?
All right, so what you've got here,
this is it.
You've got the MakerBot Replicator 2, and let me show you how it works. It's you've got the material coming from the back and going into the extruder. The extruder is kind of like a fancy hot glue gun. It draws in plastic, and you can see it's drawing on this piece of plastic, and when it's done, it goes down a little bit and draws another layer on top of that, and layer by layer it builds it up, and it's actually right now building a bracelet.
Uh-huh.
And this will be done in just like 10 minutes.
It being the holidays, we're gonna do a big holiday-themed public challenge. Describe
yes.
that.
We are challenging the entire world to contribute ornaments. Basically, design ornaments, upload them to Thingiverse.com, and we're going to go ahead and make them, and we're going to have a pretty amazing award ceremony.
So these are holiday-themed ornaments. For instance, a Christmas tree ornament, or any holiday ornament you wish.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see what kind of creativity emerges.
For those who are more daunted by anything to do with computers or design, we have a second part of the challenge for
That's right.
that anybody can participate in, which is...
Well, if you've got a holiday thing that will fit on the digitizer, which is 8 inches in diameter by 8 inches tall, that could be an ornament, that could be a decoration. Go ahead and take a picture of it, send it on in, and we'll check it out. And we're going to scan the best ones and make copies of those.
And for people who either live in New York or are going to be in New York, on December 17th at the Green Space here in SoHo, we're going to have a live festival that you and I will host together. 3D print the winning designs in front of people and just revel in the miracle of 3D printing.
Yeah, it's going to be a great party.
If you'd like to see one of those 3D printers in action, we've got a video at studio360.org. While you're there, you can get all the details about our 3D printer challenge with MakerBot. The deadline is soon, December 2nd, and if you're going to be in New York City on December 17th, come to our live 3D printing fiesta. Again, all the information about the show and tickets is at studio360.org/3D.
The power of another dimension.
Green.
That's a magic number. It's the magic number.
I'm a printer.
Coming up, the comedian who brought down a president.
We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile.
The great Will Rogers. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're not supposed to judge books by their covers, although we do, of course. That's the point of covers. And that's a big point of Warren Laird's ingenious one-of-a-kind novel, A Life in Books, The Rise and Fall of Blue Mobley, in which we see all the covers of all 101 books supposedly written by the narrator over the last several decades.
I am not the hero some have made me out to be, that I made myself out to be. I violated a sacred trust. If only I understood better myself how I let this happen, and when exactly I started losing my way. I'm still trying to puzzle it out, how a life writes itself, how one thing leads to another without a plan or a map, how a simple compulsion to tell stories turned into something else, twisted this way and that.
So, as the novel's hero, this guy Blue Mobley, tells his story, we get a glimpse of each of his 101 books along the way. Lehrer, the real-life author, has designed covers and written excerpts for all the books. You can check out some of the covers at studio360.org. There is fiction, there are art books, political screeds, goofy self-help. There's a book called Outsourcing Grandma, another one called Narcissistic Planet Disorder.
There once was a planet that thought it was the center of the universe, without a care in the cosmos for anyone but itself. Planet E is now on the verge of going completely out of control.
And one of my favorites is a history of capital punishment for kids in the form of a pop-up book called How Bad People Go Bye-Bye.
Early times when a man did wrong, pull the tab, we threw some stones till he was gone. Then, if someone killed or stole, on the guillotine their head would roll. Nowadays, a prick in the arm, and the bad man can do no harm.
A Life in Books is Warren Laird's 10th book and his first novel. I asked him about his main character, his narrator, his hero, Blue Mobley. Who is he, and what's his story?
He is a writer and artist who finds himself in prison looking back on his life and career, which includes having been a journalist, an experimental novelist, an accidental best-selling author, pop culture pundit, and now unindicted prisoner. He's
a prisoner who's told the story of somebody in the White House that the authorities aren't sure if he's made up or not.
And he's refusing to reveal the name of his confidential source. And, you know, he's a guy who's always trying to tell the story that isn't otherwise being told, of the uncelebrated.
And how many of his 101 books that you've invented are actual book ideas that you've had over the years and say, hey, I should do this self-help book. I should do this pop-up book.
I had about a dozen or so to begin with.
That were actual thoughts that you'd stuck in a drawer somewhere for a book you might do one day?
Definitely. And I also had some short stories and interior narratives that I had been writing that found their way into this book, although changed.
So this novel is about Blue Mobley, who is a funny, highly eclectic author who also does innovative book design. He's a native New Yorker. He has these fairly fervent anti-establishment opinions. Sounds, except for the fact that you're not super famous yet and aren't in prison, a lot like you.
Well, Blue Mobley started with my experiences and background to a certain extent, but there's all kinds of things in his story and in his character that really more and more, as I wrote this, departed from me. But then again, I show up in other characters, as do, you know, other people who I've met.
So the DNA you've transplanted from yourself into him, and but not he's not a clone.
No. He's much more interesting than I am.
I'll take your word for that. But given that this was let me hit it out of the park, meta-fictional project, I can imagine that the next one, it'll be hard to top yourself, right? If it's just a normal novel like the rest of us, right?
No, I have a great desire to make something smaller and that will take less time and will be quite pruned.
So you're the designer of this highly designed book as well as the writer. You've created the 100 different book covers to all of Blue Mobley's books, all in different styles reflecting several decades of graphic design history. I suspect you probably are a book collector yourself.
I am.
What do you collect?
I collect particularly works of visual literature. I was recently asked to give my list for a designers and books website, and I focused it on works where the writing and the composition of the writing on the page come together.
So things such as what? From
well,
the 20s and 30s?
Dating back to Marinetti and Mallarmé and Gertrude Stein, but also in the contemporary realm, Mark Danielewski, books like House of Leaves and Only Revolutions, which really ask the reader to navigate in unusual ways. Jonathan Safran Foer, Myra Kalman, Joanna Drucker. That makes this a fantastic moment for writers and people who engage in visual literature. That revolution that the Dadaists and the Futurists were talking about at the turn of the last century is really starting to happen now in a way where in regular old bookstores, you're seeing these odd things happening on the pages of novels, maybe now 5 out of 100 books instead of 0 out of 100
or, yes,
books.
Or 1 out of 1,000, yeah.
Yeah, and that it doesn't only have to be children's books or cookbooks where we acknowledge the fact that books can be a visual medium just like film is a visual medium and the theater and the stage is a visual medium. And that's what's been, for people like me, sorely lacking in some of the great literature. Of course, I can read many a book that is in the crystal goblet slabs of text, and it works. But
that's not all that you can do.
There's so much more that's possible.
Yeah. Warren Lehrer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt. It's been a pleasure.
The Rise and Fall of Blue Mobley is out now, and you can see a slideshow of Blue Mobley's book covers at studio360.org.
Since all of us found out that healthcare.gov was not doing so well, and by all of us, I mean all of us.
Anyway, now both candidates get some much-needed rest. I guess Mondale in the Virgin Islands, Reagan in the cabinet meetings.
Lyndon Johnson, they didn't let him talk for the first 6 months.
Before John Stewart, before Johnny Carson, before Lenny Bruce, there was Will Rogers.
But with Congress, every time they make a joke, it's a law, you know.
A very folksy Oklahoman and 20th century America's first political comic.
And every time they make a law, it's a joke.
In the 1920s and 30s, he was a superstar. And his most consequential bit of comedy was a speech he gave in 1931 that was later called Bacon, Beans, and Limousines. A recording of that speech has just been entered into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. To tell the story of Bacon, Beans, and Limousines, we've got an archivist.
My name is Steve Gregert. I am director of the Will Rogers Memorial Museums in Claremore and Ooligah, Oklahoma.
A Pulitzer Prize-nominated biographer.
My name is Richard D. White, Jr., and the name of the book is Will Rogers, A Political Life.
And a political satirist.
My name is Lewis Black, and I'm a stand-up comic, a playwright, and an actor. And I was born and raised around Washington, D.C., and if you're born and raised around Washington, D.C., and you don't know who Will Rogers is, then chances are you probably take antidepressants.
Don't get scared and start turning off your radios, huh? I'm not advertising or trying to sell you anything. If the mouthwash you're using is not the right kind and it tastes sort of like sheep dip, why, you just have to go right on using it. I can't advise any other kind at all. And if the cigarettes that you're using, why, if they don't lower your Adam's apple, why, I don't know of any that will. You just have to cut out apples, I guess. That's the only thing I know.
There was a real gentleness to his form of satire that is truly admirable. It gave the same sting, but did not need to be done in the kind of a harsh fashion that certainly myself and a number of other comics practice. Now,
I say, and have always claimed, that things would pick up in 32. Well, why 32? Well, because 32 is an election year. See? And the Republicans always see that everything looks good on election year, see? They give us three bad years and one good one, but the good one always comes on the year that the voting is, see? The Democrats are always just 1 year late with their election, see? Now, if they was running this year, well, they'd be all right, but they're 1 year late. Everything will pick up next year and be fine.
The title, Bacons and Beans Limousines, refers to the range of issues that Will Rogers is addressing. Bacons and beans, the common folks' meal, limousines representing the wealthy class.
We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile.
No one has ever taken over the media like Will Rogers. In the 1930s, Will was the most widely read newspaper columnist. He had a radio audience of 60 million. He wrote several books, and he was the number one box office attraction at the movies next to Shirley Temple.
That's the kind of impact that he had, and that's why presidents and other politicians sought him out. That's why Herbert Hoover would want him on the air on October the 18th, 1931.
My fellow citizens, this broadcast tonight marks the beginning of the mobilization of the whole nation for a great
undertaking. The Bacons and Beans Limousine speech, the production that night was part of a nationwide broadcast.
There has never been a situation like this where a president has shared the microphone with a personality like Will.
It's unimaginable at this point in time that a comedian would speak before the President of the United States.
I'm here this evening appearing on the bill with Mr. Hoover. So I expect you won't hear any more of Amos and Andy. It'll just be Hoover and Rogers from now on.
The main issue that Will and the President were addressing was giving some sort of relief to the American public in the throes of a depression.
With the foreclosures among farmers, the banks that were closing, 3,600 in 1930 to 31, the effects of the drought, the unemployment, which was in double figures.
The only problem that confronts this country today is that at least 7 million people are out of work. That's our only problem. There is no other one before us at all. It's to see that every man that wants to, able to work, is allowed to find a place to go to work, and also to arrange some way of getting a more equal distribution of the wealth in country.
I believe that the words equal distribution of wealth are really kind of important words, and as much a cornerstone of what American democracy is truly all about, even though it's not written in the Constitution.
Will Rogers disagreed with Hoover, but he said he was a good man.
Happiness hasn't been a steady diet with our president. He's had a very tough uphill fight. He's a very human man.
Now, that may be damning with faint praise, because when you say he's a nice man, you're also not saying that he's a great leader or a great statesman or that he's trying to solve the problems of the nation. This timing of this speech was probably the political death of Herbert Hoover and the upswing of Franklin D. Roosevelt. I mean, you could pin it on this date of this speech.
I don't suppose there's the most unemployed or the hungriest man in America has contributed in some way to the wealth of every millionaire in America. It wasn't the working class that brought this condition on at all. It was the big boys themselves who thought that this financial drunk we were going through was going to last forever. They over-merged and over-capitalized and over everything else. That's the fix that we're in now.
If we took away everything else he said and you just had him say
equal
distribution
of
wealth to our great-grandchildren so that they could then look it up, maybe if they don't know what it means anymore at all, and go, wow, that was an interesting idea.
That was Lewis Black. We also heard from Steve Gregert and Richard White. Our Peabody Award-winning series on the National Recording Registry is produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich from BMP Audio. You can hear lots more of those stories at studio360.org.
So long.
Coming up, don't ask the musician who calls herself Al Specs what her real name is, because wouldn't that defeat the whole point of having a pseudonym?
I think the artist is a separate individual from the person, and I just wasn't comfortable with having my name out there.
Al Specs performs with her band Cold Specs. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
1,000 stillborn thoughts to cradle and hold.
Studio 360 is supported by 23andMe. The DNA kit from 23andMe is designed to provide more than 200 personalized health reports and the knowledge to make informed decisions about personal health. A personalized DNA kit is available at 23andMe.com/studio360. And by Arts Brookfield, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary with Art Set Free, a global art showcase offering emerging, established, and amateur artists everywhere the opportunity to share their art with millions worldwide. Details at artsbrookfield25.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Musicians these days don't have to depend on their labels or critics to categorize the music they make. They can do it themselves when they upload their songs to iTunes or SoundCloud. The musician who's going by the name Al Specs invented a new genre for herself, doom soul slash gothic gospel. It started out as a joke, but it stuck, and it's not really inaccurate. The band she's put together to play her music is called Cold Specs. She and two of her musicians are here with me right now, Al Specs. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hello.
So I have a lot to ask you about, but will you start us off with the song, Send Your Youth?
Yeah.
Great.
For this spring, took my hand, yeah, he took my hand, showed me how to keep a good man. Said, oh, my darling, leave it to good time to decide what is born and what is left to die. I turned my heart to the all high and said, oh, high, high, will you make my bed? And oh, my Lord, will you take my place? Very weary child was made for the spring. Stay with me. Hey, now if you bury this dream, this hunger, hunger, I know it ain't clean. I send my youth into the night. I let it kill what I knew wasn't right. He took my head, yeah, he took my head. Said, oh, high, high, will you make my bed? And, oh, my Lord, will you take my claim? This very weary child I was made for the spring.
That was Cold Specs, singer-songwriter Al Specs on vocals, with Tom Green on piano and Chris Cundy on sax, performing Send Your Youth off their new album, I Predict a Graceful Expulsion. So as I've been listening to this music, I hear, along with soul and gospel, a distinct folk piece as well. Yeah?
Yeah. I started out really, when I was in university, when I first really got into music, I was really listening to a lot of folk, like the American Anthology of Folk Music and Alan Lomax recordings, to newer stuff like Bill Callahan and Will Oldham. A lot of that definitely seeped into my songwriting, I think.
Was it old Alan Lomax recordings that got you interested in the music of the American South and gospel and that kind of thing?
I think so. I didn't really ever listen to gospel music, but I was listening to a lot of soul singers who were heavily influenced by gospel music. And I guess it's just a sort of cycle where that seeped into their music and it naturally seeped into mine as well. It wasn't until afterwards that I went back and listened to people like Mahalia Jackson.
Given that influence and given the spiritual, existential quality of a lot of your lyrics, did you grow up going to church?
Nope.
Nope?
Not a Christian. My family's not even a Christian family. Just we're Muslims. My family are from Mogadishu.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're a Somali-Canadian, I guess?
Yeah.
Would be the hyphenate that
yeah.
you would go by? You've said in the past that when you were writing these songs, you could barely play the guitar. It must have been scary to go into a studio with all professional musicians and here I'm on the guitar.
It was really, at first, it was this incredibly daunting experience. I didn't know the people who were playing on the record very well. I didn't know my songs very well. There are a lot of unknowns.
Wow, you could have failed in so many ways.
I could have. Luckily, I didn't.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
Oh, so well now you're fully an adult. You began writing music when you were a teenager?
Sort of. In high school, and I was attempting to write songs, just morbid, emo, teenage nonsense.
That's what teenagers do. Can we hear another one? Not teenage emo nonsense?
Just an adult emo nonsense. Elephant Head?
Great.
Stillborn thoughts to cradle and hold with my mother's hands. I'll place them on my chest and hope for these empty winds to breathe. No, I won't rest when the house is to shame. Call out to these waters, yes, you great lakes. Do I bury them with names? Become me open just to see what's within. Clean up these organs, wrap your words with my skin. Guess I'm just looking for a transplant lover with infinite regrets. Someone will dance around matters and sing of caskets. What do you say? Now what do you say? It's a strange year. It appears that I am stuck, but I predict a graceful expulsion. I predict a graceful expulsion. St. George and Bay, am I to condemn the hands of darkness? Now tell it to the quiet fire of my blood. Tell it to the eager fever of my heart. Who expulsion.
That is the band Cold Specs, Al Specs, Tom Green, and Chris Cundy performing Elephant Head from their album, kind of the title track of I Predict a Graceful Expulsion, their latest record. You talk a lot in the lyrics on this record about Toronto, where you grew up, name particular streets and lakes and landmarks. But now you've moved to London, not London, Ontario, but the English one. Is that going from Canada back to...
Are you Canadian?
What?
Are you Canadian?
I am not Canadian. Oh, I'm Nebraskan. So is as close to Canada as America gets in a certain way. But no, I'm not Canadian. But I'm interested in Canadians and Canada. Is that the reference of Graceful Expulsion, your self-deportation back to the old country?
The word expulsion represents a lot of things. Moving is probably one of them, but it's also just letting go of a lot of things. You know, people, faith in things, faith in love, faith in a higher power.
Uh-huh. And Al Specs, the pseudonym. Why did you decide to perform with a pseudonym rather than your lovely actual name?
I just wasn't comfortable with having my name out there. I think the artist is a separate individual from the person. And the record is really sad at times and really morbid. And I didn't want that attached to my name. And I just thought, you know, the record was written about a certain time in my life. And that's not really representative of who I am now. And I'd rather leave my name out of it.
Keep a boundary between who you really
exactly.
are. Exactly.
It wasn't until I sort of embraced the Al Specs persona on stage that I was able to play these songs.
And I take it the real you isn't so crazy about playing shows?
The real me, if she had her way, would want to be Jan Deck.
You mean be a nobody in Nowheresville that may not exist?
Just make a bunch of records and put them online, but...
This is the business you have chosen.
Yeah, this is a bit, and I'm going to grow up and suck it up and just play shows and attempt to sell records.
Excellent. Al Specs, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me and talking with me.
Could you play us out with a song?
Sure. This last song is Blank Maps.
Down, keep your eyes closed, ear to the ground. Pick up in the middle of the night, kill the silence, I can't bear to speak. Head for the heart, does it break? Words may fall, the body remains, and every map is blank. When my words head for the cracks, we have my back. We were good children, darling, let it out. When my words head for the cracks, we have my back. We were good children, darling, let it out. I hold my breath, no, not to move when the night comes. Who will you be? Even the dead can be astoundingly alive. Well, I am a goddamn believer. Well, I am a goddamn believer. When head for the crowd. ocean, darling, will you let it out? Will you let it out? Will you let it out?
Cold Speck's album is called I Predict a Graceful Expulsion, and they are now back in the studio, their own studio, working on a new record. That's it for this hour of the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week, but until then, you can keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And don't forget, we want you to take our 3D printing challenge and to come to our 3D printing holiday party. All the details are at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiever.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know about the witches and the munchkins.
Follow the yellow brick road.
But the land of Oz is stranger than you ever imagined. We'll discover why this American icon continues to inspire countless filmmakers, musicians, and novelists. The Wizard of Oz, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.